Well, thank you, Paul, and welcome to everybody. I'm styled their chairman of a biotech company, so one of the descriptions of what I'm doing is that you're dealing with a professional superficialist at this level. But what I wanted to do was, when I've mastered this bit, is to take you through the processing and the generation of electricity from nuclear reactors. But I thought I ought to start with this wonderful quote from Patrick Monaghan, which really is relevant to the debate, because there are all sorts of numbers and figures which are quoted. And we'll see, I hope, as we go through where they come from. Most of them have got some truth. They come from something which is related to the business we're going to be discussing. But it is very interesting in trying to separate facts from opinions. And I hope, in my case, that I'll stick to the facts. It may be quite obvious to you when I do have opinions, and I'll try also and signal when I've got my own opinions. But the process that we're going to deal with is just going through the mining and the preparing the uranium for burning in the reactor, and then subsequently the appropriately named back end, where I'm afraid even pop language is penetrated, where in the back end the metals which are being processed are referred to as heavy metals. So let me just say, what we're dealing with first of all is uranium, which is not a scarce element in the Earth's crust. It consists of two isotopes, U-235, which is found in concentration of 0.7%, and the balance is essentially U-238. I'm also going to be talking about enriched uranium, which is where you raise the level of U-235 to about 3.5% to 4%. And I'll say a little bit about depleted uranium, which is a result of the enrichment process, the tailings, which come out at around 0.2% or so. Now, this is a summary of the costs, and it comes from mid-April 2006. And you can see front end, yellow cake, U-308. Conversion is taking that yellow cake and turning it into uranium hexafluoride, which is a gas which you need for the separation processes in enrichment. And then that gas has to be turned back to uranium oxide, which is then made into pellets and fabricated into fuel rods, which are burned in the reactor. And in due course, those rods are withdrawn. The uranium in them can either be sent for reprocessing, in which case you can separate out uranium plutonium from the other radioactive elements in the spent fuel, and possibly the final disposal. So that's the pathway that I want to follow. And let me just go immediately to mining. Now, we've mentioned, chairman mentioned that Australia has the largest portion of, now I've said presently known resource in terms of uranium. But what you should remember is two things. One, once there's a shortage or there's a rush on some metal or some mineral, then it's remarkable how resources can be discovered. And there are shades in this debate of a revisiting of the Club of Rome, that we're going to run out of resources. Now, the resource availability actually depends on price. And when people make these estimates, these are always economic reserves, which are that you value the rock in the ground at a certain amount, and what you've got to be able to do is mine it and deliver it to the next stage of whatever process there is and make some money on it. And the only thing which you should remember about the Australian reserves is something like 1.5 million tonnes of uranium in Roxby Downs is only valued as a reserve because it's actually a byproduct of copper. And it's responsible for perhaps 20% or so of the revenue of Roxby Downs, but it is a byproduct. So if for some reason there were hiccups in the price of copper, then those reserves are not necessarily fixed, and in fact at no time are reserves fixed just because of the economic nature of them. The only other thing in terms of resources is that we're not the only player, and I've said in terms of deposits, Canada, Kazakhstan and Russia, and I probably should have added South Africa as at least presently a supplier. The demand at the moment is for about 40,000 tonnes of yellowcake, which is forecast in 25 years to rise to possibly double that, 80,000 tonnes, although maybe a little less if there's a certain amount of recycling of processed fuel, and that's MOX, that's the mixed oxide fuel. The only things which have an impact on the mining in Australia are, of course, the local, the federal policies and regulations, and then there are a number of international treaties which govern who you can sell to, and there's an example of that at the moment with the issue about should we sell uranium to India. So just going back to this table, you can see there that in terms of the fraction of the total cost of fuel, and in this total cost, I've been bold enough to actually put in the back end cost because I think one has to. But you could actually look at this, and I would say to you, particularly the back end, that that's a curbside estimate of the value. It could be $500 a kilogram, could be $1,500 a kilogram. I've just taken the middle of the range. But if you look at all of that, and again you think about the values in this processing cycle, then in fact mining uranium constitutes something like 40 or 50% of the front end of the process, and overall something like 27%. It's not a bad chunk of the feeding chain, particularly if you can make money out of it, because it's not obvious that money is made from some of the other elements which go into this. So let's go look at the next, which is really conversion, enrichment and fabrication. Now, conversion is simply taking the yellow cake and turning it into the gas uranium hexafluoride. There are five major suppliers. There are actually a couple of commercial operations in Canada and the United States. There may be a third one in France. I think that's best qualified by saying that's a matter of opinion. The plants are typically between 6,000 and 12,000 tonnes, and I'll come back to capital costs of these in due course. But the interesting thing about the whole of the nuclear fuel cycle, and you should think about this when people talk about Australia leasing fuel, that the processing occurs all over the world. So we could ship yellowcake out of Australia. It could be converted in a plant, say, in Canada. It could be shipped to somewhere in France or the UK or Netherlands for processing. It could then go as the oxide to wherever the reactor builders actually fabricate the fuel rods, and it could finally then go to another country, say Japan, where it was burned in the reactor, and then finally it could come out of that and be sent back to perhaps France or the United Kingdom for reprocessing before being returned, and as is the present custom, to the country that actually burned the fuel. So that's conversion. Enrichment. The technology for enrichment, the technology of choice now is using centrifuges. There are diffusion plants, and just as an aside, at the height of the Cold War, when the United States was at its maximum in building nuclear weapons, 7% of the electricity generated in the United States went to driving diffusion plants. Absolutely extraordinary. Centrifuges have much less demand on energy. And also going on, and it's in this country, it's a singular contribution by company which is actually based up in Lucas Heights. It came out of ANSTO, called Silex Systems, where they are developing a laser enrichment process, which they've just dealt to General Electric in the United States. And it's very interesting because the best comparison between diffusion or centrifuge and laser is the equivalent of trying to find a needle in a haystack by, say, throwing the straw up into the wind and hoping it'll separate, as opposed to going into the haystack with a magnet and pulling the needle out. I mean, if it works, it may be quite extraordinary, and it could be quite extraordinary because it has a number of other impacts in terms of nuclear proliferation. If you're able to enrich in a single pass, then, that imposes some very real obligations on this country or whoever the developer of that method is. For instance, at the moment, you cannot see what the process is. It's patented, but they are patents which are unavailable and presumably will not be. I mean, the equivalent example is the trigger for the atom bomb, which, again, is patented, but which has never been made available to anyone outside of the U.S. defense industry. So that laser enrichment may be a quite extraordinary innovation. There are six primary suppliers of enrichment, and it's billed as there's a court case going on in the United States between enrichment operators in Europe and one of the U.S. corporations engaged in enrichment. And part of that hinges on, is this a service or is this a manufacturing process? And it looks as though it's going to be seen as a service, but there are at least in Europe one commercial company, Urenco. You can go and actually inspect their accounts, see what their costs are, see what their plans for expansion. And there is also in the US a commercial enrichment plant. But there are also plants, smaller, quite large ones, as you'd expect in Russia, and then very much smaller plants in Japan and China. Again, people here talk about, well, why shouldn't we do enrichment? Well, you're working against a background of established suppliers who find it relatively easy to expand demand by adding centrifuges because they're small units, they can do it. A lot of this business is done under contract, so it's perfectly possible to forecast what you're going to need in the next 5 or 10 years. And again, this enrichment process is subject to regulation by governments. I'm only aware of the particular regulations in the United States, but no doubt there will be in the terms of nuclear proliferation treaties, there will also be restrictions on what can be done. The fabrication, which is the final stage, is usually actually carried out by the manufacturer of the reactor because the rods have to be designed to fit into the particular shape of the reactor. And overall, the capacity that's available is for about 10,000 tonnes of enriched uranium, enriched in between 3 and 4%. So, again, just going back to looking at the costs there, conversion is a minor part of the process. There is an interesting game that you can imagine may be played. If the cost of uranium rises much more, then it may be, in terms of enrichment, that you might drive the enrichment a bit further. Now, what that actually means is that you, rather than have tails at 0.25%, you might drop the tails to 0.15%, and that extra uranium then, or that extra bit of the isotope then goes into giving you more enriched uranium. And so you can see in terms of supply and demand certain games which might be played in that. Now, having said that, let's go on because we've got now the fuel and just look at nuclear power generation. Now, these power stations are very large objects. 1,000 to 1,500 megawatts. People are talking about standardized units, which are certainly that sort of size. And, in fact, the generator sets, which are driven by the reactors, by the boilers, are between 500 and 1,000 megawatts and single units of 1,000 megawatts. And I think the largest unit in Australia at the moment is up in New South Wales, is about 660 megawatts, and in Victoria, 500 megawatts. High capital cost, $2 million to $3 million. I'll come on to much more detail about the cost, but that's per megawatt, and low fuel cost, $8 per megawatt hour, and it's of the order of 10 to 20% of the cost. And the characteristic which you have to bear in mind is that these are really baseload power stations. They, you like to get the reactor up and running 24 hours a day, because in terms of the economics, these are capital intensive. They need to run. And the question is, in terms of thinking about Victoria or New South Wales or Queensland, what's the base load? Is there room for one of these stations? In Victoria, at 3 a.m., the base load demand is about 4,000 to 4,500 megawatts, of which maybe 1,000 megawatts is going to the smelter, and the rest is keeping traffic lights, bridges, hot water services, probably computer and telephone charges and all those other things going. But it's quite extraordinary because it's about half of the peak demand and it just sits there all the time. And then you come to, well, how do I integrate something as large as this into a network? And you have to think about things like connection costs, because if you had to have a couple of hundred kilometres of 500 kV cable, then you may be adding another $500 million to the cost of your reactor. So that's one side. The other side is the risk that you run in having a 1,000 megawatt power plant, because in general in running a system, what you try and have in reserve is a reserve which is at least as big as the largest unit which is actually running. And if you only have one of these, then what you're going to have is a backup. And there are figures which tells you what the optimum size of a reactor ought to be for a market of a particular size in terms of the safety and the reserve requirements that you need. And these large stations would actually make you think and consider how you'd actually integrate something into a system. You may not be able to integrate it into a single New South Wales or Victoria or Queensland system. The other thing which is very obvious is regulation in terms of siting and safety. And the only thing that I can see, and it's not really a co-product, because you actually use electricity to drive the pumps to give you desalination of water, but that certainly is an alternative use of the electricity which is generated from nuclear power generation. Now, let me just return to the costs. This is an interesting slide which comes from University Group in Finland, and all you really need to look at, if I can get this pointer to work, is to note the capital cost element and also the fuel element, which is at the top of the stack. And you can see this is it. This is in euros, and it gives you a snapshot of what the relative costs are for different systems. And you see people claiming, well, nuclear power, 23 euros per megawatt hour is probably something like $40 per megawatt hour in Australia. But that's a snapshot. There are all sorts of things which have gone into this. And for instance, down here, let me just go back one. Down at the bottom here, there's a real interest rate of 0.5%. Now, that's a hint at what you see in this next slide. And this is a very useful unpacking of what the costs are for nuclear power. And it shows you in two groups of discount rate of 5 and 10%. And it's broken up, as you can see, into investment, operation, maintenance, fuel, and then the total. And, of course, the operations and the fuel are not subject to interest rate changes, at least in a direct sense. And so you can see that there really are two uncertainties in the building of any power plant. One is the uncertainties in construction costs, but it can also be uncertainties in regulation when you start building. If regulations change and you have to make alterations, then that's that could well be a serious cost increase. So this is very useful unpacking. And the lesson from this is that when you look over on the far right-hand side, you see the final cost. Now, I could say to you, well, look, nuclear power, it looks as though I can do it from anywhere between $20 and about $52 a megawatt hour. And all of that. Sorry, I've been told I'm fading out. So all of this has to be taken into account when people start to talk about nuclear power. And the lesson I would draw from this, and this is my opinion, is that nuclear power looks as though it, from an economic point of view, is within the general parameters of being a competitive power plant. But until you actually have a specific site, you know where it is, you know the system that it's going to be operating in, you know what the regulations are, and people have actually sat down and costed it, you will not know whether it is worth investing in or not. And so I think that part of the debate is really not very sensible. The issues really are regulation. And I'm afraid, going back to my role in drug development, what you do there is you have a regulator. If you can prove that what you've got is safe and effective, then you can get a license to sell in the country which has got those regulations. The issue for the governments in the first instance really are we satisfied with the arrangements which would govern the safety and the operation and the ultimate disposal of these plants? It's not about cost. So going to the next slide, and this I just wanted to put in because, again, on baseload power stations, perhaps I should wander off with this slide, and on baseload power stations, you have to have continuous supply. Now, this is a very interesting slide which comes from Germany. E.ON Netz is a distributor of electricity. I mean, it's one of the planet's largest energy companies, and it has a subsidiary which is the distributor of electricity in the northwest of Germany. It has within its boundaries 7,000 megawatts of installed wind farms. It's the biggest single set, I believe, in any country, bigger than anything in the United States. And they have to manage it. And this is an example which is in their what they call their annual wind report. And it's Christmas 2004, and it simply shows that on Christmas Eve they were belting along at something like 6,000 megawatts, which was their record output for the year. And in the space of something like 8 hours or so, they lost 4,000 of those megawatts. And they show the gradient there being of the order of 16 megawatts a minute. Now, what has to happen when you have that sort of behavior is you've got to make it up and fill it in by some other power stations. And that was eight coal-burning power stations, eight 500-megawatt coal-burning power stations, which individually are not capable of reaching probably 15 or 16 megawatts a minute. The best we can do, I think, in the Latrobe Valley is about 5 megawatts a minute in terms of big power stations. So this is essentially, if you like, sort of formation dancing and coordinating the rising output of these power stations. And then you can see, having gone through all of that effort, it rose again and then it fell, and then on Boxing Day it was down to about 40 megawatts. So the real issue in terms of this is what's the appropriate sort of generator that you need for base load power stations. And it's a complicated question with no answers, I think, except looking again at gas, at coal, and possibly nuclear. So that's essentially the end of all I wanted to say about electricity generation. And now I wanted to move to the back end. And again, in technology, Australia's made a singular contribution in terms of Synroc, invented by Professor Ted Ringwood at the ANU, and now under development at Lucas Heights, and being looked at seriously by British Nuclear Fuels as a way of disposing of some particularly nasty waste which they have. But the standard is actually vitrified waste, just putting it in glass. There are plants which operate in France and in the UK, and they serve customers worldwide. And in general, what happens is the customers take back the waste in the form of vitrified glass, and they take back the stripped fuel, where there's been finger trouble there, and that returns to the front end, where it gets mixed. It can get mixed in with fresh uranium coming from the mines. It can also be mixed in with the weapons-grade uranium, which is also being fed, and plutonium, which is being fed in for use in reactors. And that's an established business. And the final bit is the what do you do with disposal? And there are there probably is only one solution, and it was realised at least by the technical people, scientists and engineers, something like 50 years ago, as deep geological burial. In Europe, Finland and Sweden are advanced in developing depositories. The US has one that's been fraught with political difficulties at Yucca Mountain. The Germans are moving towards one, and the French have also just taken the decision, as have the Canadians. And incidentally, Canada is very interesting because it's the one country outside of the United States which actually has a complete integrated business. You can go all the way from mining uranium through conversion. They don't go in for enrichment because they've developed their own reactors, CANDU reactors, which burn natural uranium, but the uranium is actually contained in heavy water, where they have to get something like 300,000 tonnes of water to give them one tonne of heavy water. So they do a different enrichment. And they then, in turn, are looking at deep geological disposal. So that's the state of play. And just to give you an idea about disposal, here is a demonstration of the decay of radioactivity. Now, this is actually in a tonne of spent fuel, and what you should really look at is the where the falling lines cross the horizontal line, which is the activity that you would find in a ton of ore in a mine in a geological setting. And if you look at that, that tells you that to get down to that level, the waste has got to be put away for a period of a few thousand years. And that, of course, is where you have the issues about who's going to look after it, what harm is it going to do, not only to people but to the environment generally. There are plans with new generations of reactors to reduce this by having a different set of waste products at the end of the burning of the uranium. And the only other thing I can say is if you look at this, you think of a 1,000-year span, there aren't too many organisations which have existed for 1,000 years, but you can certainly point to the church, universities. I don't know, maybe libraries, but none of the above may be appropriate to be the guardians of this. But it's certainly possible to have organisations which live. But the real idea of this is that you would seal after 20 or 30 years. You would actually seal the waste in a site, and that would be the end of it, never to be dealt with again. So you should just look at that and remember, because you will find people claiming that this waste is dangerous up to 300,000-400,000 years. And I suppose I should say that's a matter of opinion, but this at least shows you what the facts are. So going back to the reprocessing, the estimated cost here is about $1,000 a kilogram. Now, that's probably quite courageous setting that cost there, because the reprocessing plants in both the UK and France have been built by governments, partly, I think, for the purpose of disposing of military waste. They've been there for a long time. As far as I can find, the best estimates of what they're doing is that they run these plants to cover their costs and to make them a little bit, and that is the way one should think about it. So, finally, if you look at capital costs, this is curbside stuff, and really all you need to do is look at the far right column, which is the asset intensity. Now, all of these things are really asset intense, of which you'd have to say that the power stations are positively heroic. When you look at that capital cost, sorry, I've lost the slide. The other side of it, though, is people, I believe, make money out of conversion. They make money out of enrichment. They make money out of fuel fabrication and building reactors. Reprocessing is problematic. Best estimate I can find in terms of reprocessing capital costs, that's a midpoint, 3.3 million per kilogram or per ton. And I'm sorry, that's for a 1,500 ton processing. It could be as high as 4.5 or 5 billion. And disposal. Now, disposal is clearly the unmet need in all of this. So let me very quickly, because I'm sure this is where questions will come from, just go to the national, international issues, public perception, major disasters, Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, the issue of waste disposal we've talked about, weapons proliferation, that gets raised all the time. I think people who talk about trying to prevent that are really trying to outlaw wickedness, but it's very difficult. And we have the example of Iran, which was a signatory to all of the agreements governing nuclear proliferation and development, quietly doing their own thing. And I suspect that no matter what restrictions, what limits, what constraints, and what legal documents get signed, if somebody wants to go and do something, they will. Contribution to international problem, the thing I'm thinking about particularly is climate change. If you have China and India, 2.4 billion people, who are moving rapidly in terms of economic development, how are they going to meet their energy needs, which are largely going to be transport and electricity? It may be that nuclear is one of the answers. And finally, we've got regulation in Australia, which is going to determine what we do. And it's where the debate ought to be, not in the sense of can we afford a power station or not. And just to give you an idea, because this again comes back to regulation, in risk mitigation, there's extraordinary amounts of money are spent in averting fatalities. This comes from a book on risk benefit analysis, and it just shows you what is spent actually in protecting a life in terms of the disposal of high level waste. as opposed to how people value lives in other areas of activity. And finally, just to finish it all off, when you look at accident rates, the nuclear accident rate, and this is done in terms of gigawatt years power generated, there's no doubt coal is the worst from the mining accidents. Nuclear, there is one contributor, which is Chernobyl, in terms of fatalities. And I think that's an appropriate place to stop, as my chairman's looking at me and has been.